I don't think the Chinese are going to try to replace the United States as a superpower. That would be a losing proposition. Their approach so far has been to see how they can co-manage the world. Perhaps they're abandoning that idea, not because they don't want to have it, but because they don't have faith in our ability to be a co-manager. And then we'll also then depend very much on what these many, many new middle powers who, compared to previous constellations of the world, we just did not have the same number of middle powers or with the same type of influence. And as we saw today, many countries would not even count Iran as a middle power, but nevertheless one that has been able to assert a tremendous amount of influence and deterrence, at least militarily, in this war.
Welcome to the Deep Focus Show. I'm Professor Richard Wolff. I'm sitting in this month as a kind of guest host, and I hope you will bear with me as I do that. Thank you for joining us, and please like, subscribe, and share so that we can continue to bring you these sorts of in-depth conversations. I want to begin by telling you that joining me today is Trita Parsi, a co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He is an expert on U.S.-Iranian relations, Iranian foreign policy, and the geopolitics of the Middle East. He has authored four books on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with a particular focus on Iran and Israel. So in terms of background, wow, is he prepared for the things we need to understand better today. And let me put in a word, I am one of many people around the world who are grateful for the Quincy Institute and the kinds of activities that it is constantly producing. I did one myself a little while ago, and it was a pleasure dealing with the people up there. If you want a sane, careful thinking about foreign policy, you can't do better than them in terms of what is being thought about, or maybe I should say should be more thought about in the realm of foreign policy here in the United States. So let me begin by saying that in a recent paper, you said something like President Trump's activities, particularly with this war on Iran, is really marking a kind of historic watershed, a shift, a paradigm shift, if you like, in which a certain dominant military position of the United States is either gone or is fading or is in somehow passing away, with results that will transform global geopolitics. Could you give us a bit of the sense of your feelings along that line?
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And thank you so much for your kind words about the Quincy Institute and my colleagues here. Yeah, so what I argue essentially is it's coming out of a webinar we did with Steve Walt, Stephen Wertheim, and Monica Tuff. We're discussing what the grand strategic implications of the result of the Iran war, as so far as we have a result right now. And the essential point is that, you know, if the United States is going to be pursuing primacy, and for that to actually be effective, it requires that the United States can project power in a very effective way. The U.S.'s own definition is that it should be able to wage two wars in two different continents at the same time. But the Iran war has shown that a smaller state, much less powerful militarily, through the use of asymmetric warfare, new technology, drones, ballistic missiles, as well as the geography of its area, have been able to not only deny the United States a victory, but actually in some aspects score a strategic victory over the United States. And this then raises really the question, not only if the United States is in any capable of sustaining American primacy in the Middle East. We're seeing now, for instance, that the U.S. cannot wrestle the control of the Strait of Hormuz out of the hands of the Iranians. but also whether this then raises questions as to whether the United States can actually pursue primacy globally any longer. And one of the assaults against primacy going forward may very well be that even though these countries that have benefited from America's security umbrella, who have free ridden on America's security in the past and who have spent millions of dollars lobbying for it to be sustained, particularly in the last 20 years, in which they have been very worried that the U.S. will withdraw, that many of them may actually stop pushing for it any longer because primacy has proven itself to neither be effective nor reliable, which means then that this grand strategy that otherwise has been under criticism by the American public, at least for the last 20 years, may now also face opposition or at least a lackluster support from those who otherwise used to lobby for it. All of this, the argument is pointing to the fact that this war may prove to be an infliction point in terms of the sustainability of primacy.
Let me pull you out a little further on this. Is what you just said something you think will happen only if Iran, in some sense, wins? Or could it also be a consequence even if, in some sense, Iran doesn't win?
I think it's more important to see if it can continue or if this will happen or not happen if the U.S. loses or wins. And at this point, it just seems very difficult to be able to point to any scenario in which the United States can say that this was militarily a victory. I mean, remember, if I compare it to what happened in the Iraq War 20 plus years ago. In the Iraq War, it's important to remember that despite the fact that that war was a debacle, that war was won in 3 weeks militarily. There was never any doubt. And even the political objective of it was successful in terms of getting rid of Saddam. Now, the United States could not stabilize the country afterwards once the insurgency erupted, and the United States lost the peace. But there was never any question as to whether it won the war militarily. That has not happened in Iran, and it is very difficult to see how it could happen going forward, mindful of the fact that the Iranians have managed to find a way to squeeze the United States and the global economy in a manner that is just simply intolerable for the United States. So even though the full picture is not clear yet, and we may end up in a negotiation in which the United States can point to a lot of successes in terms of the final deal, it does not mean that the war was won militarily. And primacy is not about whether the United States wins things diplomatically. I mean, that's part of the problem with primacy in the first place, of course. It's whether the United States is in that predominant position of military power.
Let me ask you another angle at this. Do you think that out of this is coming a global revaluation or an increase in the value that the world as a whole assigns to whatever the complicated relationship is between China, Russia, and Iran? I mean, clearly they are working together. The backstop that Chinese production and Russian military prowess, what we've learned a little bit about in the Ukraine war, they now look to me, and I'm interested in your opinion, as a more formidable force than they looked 2 months ago.
It's a good question. I can't claim to have the answer to that, but let me point to something that perhaps suggests that that is not necessarily the first natural conclusion or outcome that will come here. Because unlike the Ukraine war, and in Ukraine, again, a smaller state managed to deny a much larger state victory through the use of technology and terrain and geography. But in the Ukraine case, of course, the Ukrainians were massively supported by the United States, by Europe, financially, militarily, equipment, intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. That is not the scenario in the Iran war. The Iranians clearly have benefited from some intelligence help from the Chinese and the Russians. There may have been other forms of help, but we're not talking about anything particularly significant. And those states would be very careful not to have too much support given to the Iranians, given the complications that would cause for their own relationships. And Iran is not that important for them to risk that with the United States. So we're actually talking about a country that has frankly relied on itself overwhelmingly and nevertheless managed to deliver that type of, at least a denial of success to the US. So I'm not so sure that it necessarily will lead to the conclusion that you suggest in May down the road because of other factors. But in the immediate terms, I think in the region, it will become clear that Iran's position has strengthened, not because it now nevertheless can project power in a manner as it did before, in which he had a stronger constellation with some of the different groups that it's allied with, but because it had shown that two nuclear powers, one of them a superpower with the support of some GCC states at least, nevertheless could not overthrow the government or bring the country to a defeat, but quite the opposite happened. That is undoubtedly going to strengthen the Iranian position geostrategically in the region. The manner in which it will automatically translate to Chinese and Russian support is a different question. And incidentally, I think, you know, the country that perhaps would study Iran a lot after this may be Taiwan, in case of their, in which there would be a confrontation between China and Taiwan, in which Taiwan as well will have to use methods and strategies that is based on it being the weaker party in that equation.
You are perhaps well positioned, given everything, to answer this question. If you're right, if this is to the credit of the Iranians, at least so far, for having, with much less help, managed to be a potent force, how much of that is explained by this reference I hear from time to time, and I'm no expert on this, that Persia is the predecessor of Iran, that Persia is a very old empire that has gone through God knows how many crises, attacks, wars. Is there something about a cohesive, self-conscious, cultural language, Farsi, all of that, that is part of the explanation for what Iran was able to do, and that you could then take that and look at other parts of the world and make reasonable assessments about them?
I think there's something to it. I would be a bit careful, however, in the sense of not necessarily presenting it as unique. Undoubtedly, the Iranians do have a very, very strong sense of national identity. If you want to fuel nationalism, which the government did both in this war as well as in the previous war when they were attacked by Israel and the United States, you have quite a lot you can rely on, and a very, very long and deep history of defending the country, having survived in that territory as a cultural entity that has a red line that goes back about 2,000 to 3,000 years. Right. Whereas, for instance, many of its neighbors who also have amazing civilizations, older civilizations than the Iranian ones, are now considered Arab states and have completely lost that connection, that line that goes back all the way to their earlier ancestors. The Iranians have that line. They're still speaking Persian. They're still religion and culture is deeply influenced by their original religion of Zoroastrianism. So it does have that. To what extent that explains the success in the war, etc., I won't be able to speak to. I think it's a factor, but it's very difficult to put a number or an assessment to that, because you also have to take into account other things. This is, at the same time, a profoundly unpopular government in Iran. You had massive protests just a month before, and a very large number of people, innocent protesters, that were killed by this government, and a very strong desire by a majority of the population, I would say, that would want to see a different government. Now, clearly, this is not a scenario such as the Saddam Hussein's Iraq or Gaddafi's Libya, in which the supporters of those systems were just a clique of people or a few families. This government clearly has the support of at least 15-20% of the country's population, which is very significant. We're talking about up to 18-19 million people at a minimum. So that's very different. But also when it comes to nationalism, this is a government that has an uncomfortable relationship under normal circumstances with Iran's pre-Islamic history and nationalism, in which it has tried to forge its own nationalism that is much, much more centered on Islam, but oftentimes at the expense and exclusion of the other sources of nationalism. But in moments like this, particularly in the summer, we saw that they were heavily relying on pre-Islamic symbols to be able to fuel that nationalism. And that was noteworthy precisely because that's not where their comfort level is. So despite the fact that we talked about how there's this very strong national identity, very strong reason for nationalism, it's at the same time governed by a government that has an uncomfortable position vis-a-vis that nationalism.
I wanted to link a little bit some of these dimensions and ask you this question. Some people looking at the global geopolitical landscape talk in terms of a decline of the U.S. empire and the rise then of a kind of either or, either a multipolar world of the sort people have dreamed of for a long time, but was never before possible, which is, and one can speculate, is that maybe why the League of Nations fell apart, or the United Nations after World War II has become the sad spectacle that it is now? Or are we going to see a Chinese empire replace the British and then the American? Is that what we can expect? And in that context of that question, where does this war with Iran, does it push in one way or another? Is it a marker suggesting one of those outcomes is more likely than the other?
So I think even before this war, we saw clear trends in which the world was transitioning towards some form of a multipolar constellation. Whether it was already multipolar or whether it will end up becoming a system that is more bipolar with a large number of middle powers. There's a deep academic discussion about that right now, but I think at a minimum, we can say that it was transitioning away from unipolarity. This war, I think, accelerated existing trends, but it may also have hit an inflection point at this. At least intellectually, I think after 6 months after this war, perhaps we will see what the final conclusion is in terms of how much governments around the world have internalized these shifts. So I think something was going on already before. What we don't know is exactly where we will end up. I am not of the view that we're going to live in some form of a Chinese unipolar system. The United States is going to remain a very, very powerful country, in many ways, perhaps more powerful than the Chinese, but no longer with the ability to exercise the type of leadership that it wanted to or did in the earlier phases of unipolarity. I think the Chinese also have a very good point in which they criticize Western narratives about China's rise, because there's a belief, a very narrow belief on the Western side, that all superpowers behave the same way. And as a result, once China becomes a superpower, it's going to start behaving the way the United States did. And the Chinese are saying we have a completely different blueprint of what type of a power we want to be and how we want to conduct ourselves based on a very, very long Chinese history of having been, at least in their own region, this superpower. I don't foresee, for instance, the Chinese adopting this type of a messianic, liberal interventionist characteristic that existed in American unipolarity, in which we thought that every problem around the world was screaming for us to come and solve it, and that we were automatically the solution to everyone else's problem, despite the fact that we had no understanding of their language, culture, or even what the problem was. I don't find it very likely that the Chinese are going to commit some of those mistakes. Are they going to develop an alliance system that is based on 750 military bases around the world, in which they make untenable commitments to undercut other countries' military security? Find that very unlikely as well. So I don't think the Chinese are going to try to replace the United States as a superpower. That would be a losing proposition. Their approach so far has been to see how they can co-manage the world perhaps they're abandoning that idea, not because they don't want to have it, but because they don't have faith in our ability to be a co-manager. And then we'll also then depend very much on what these many, many new middle powers who, compared to previous constellations of the world, we just did not have the same number of middle powers or with the same type of influence. And as we saw today, many countries would not even count Iran as a middle power, but nevertheless, one that has been able to assert a tremendous amount of influence and deterrence, at least militarily, in this war.
Because your biography of you indicates that you have also been a student of the situation of Israel, I would like to hear what you have to say about what you imagine. And I know, you know, none of us can look into the future, and it's open-ended and maybe even more than usual. But nonetheless, some basic aspects of Israel's context have changed and will not go back to what they were. And Iran was always, or at least for as long as I've been aware of things, a big issue for Israel, or at least they spoke as if it were. What do you think is going to happen to Israel? Its reliance on the United States, its relationship to the Gulf states, to Iran, to its own idea of settler colonialism, or whatever you want to call it. How do you understand the position of Israel as it is now changing?
Let me first preface by saying I would not claim in any way, shape, or form to be an expert on Israel, but I would suspect that if I was one of those people within the Israeli elite that helped form and establish Israel, fought in many of its wars, and are still around, and I mean, obviously I would be at a very high age, I would be very, very depressed, because it would almost come across as a life wasted. I think many of them did believe that peace at some point was desirable and achievable. I remember an Israeli general told me, this is already back in 2004, 2005, he fought in many of the wars, and he said that he is terrified of the situation, because when he fought in those wars, he said, there was a widespread belief that if we win the war, eventually the Arabs will make peace with us. And he said the youth of Israel back then, this is 20 plus years ago, had no longer any belief in peace or even a belief that it is desirable or achievable, but essentially has resigned themselves to be in a state of perpetual war, and that there's nothing more that can be achieved by that. So all you need to do is just constantly dominate and outgun all of your neighbors, not allow any of them to be able to become a co-equal with Israel, or even just be able to challenge its dominance. And that's just it. There's nothing more to the world, to Israel's existence, than that. And was very worried about that, believing that this would eventually obviously not work. And I think that date may have come much sooner, not because of Israel having suffered defeats necessarily militarily against Hamas or against Hezbollah, but because Israel has lost an entire generation of Americans. And without the United States, the ability to sustain, finance that machine is simply not going to be there. And this is going to force Israel to rethink. And it doesn't mean necessarily that it will rethink or that it will rethink it the right way.
Yeah, I will only add that in my little research about this, the early in the history of Israel, a significant part of what that society was about was the exodus of socialist Jews from Europe and from elsewhere, but particularly from Europe, and that the kibbutzim and those other components of early Israeli life had a very different notion of where it could go. I'm not saying they didn't make mistakes and all that, but I don't know where they are or where their children or their progeny are. But I would say that you're quite right about the change of opinion here in the United States, which I find remarkable, having lived through it, but also that it's the socialist lefty part of the Jews of America that have been lost particularly, and that there is something they may not have thought about when they got rid of that part of their society. It's another way of saying what you're saying, but you might have wanted to keep something that wasn't just important for your own culture, but had a lot to do with that support from the United States, which I find, especially in my students, John. I still teach at the university, still in my students. Okay, the last question we have time for, and maybe you've already answered it, but I still want to put it on the table. How much stronger, assuming the outcome is within the range of what we've been talking about, how much stronger will the Iranian government in power now be when this is over than it was before?
I think that's a very important question. I think it tells us also something about the idiocy of thinking that these type of wars are going to be successful and that the United States can socially redesign countries. In the short run, the government is going to be much, much more powerful. Nationalism has reduced the distance between society and the government for now. There is still a tremendous amount of bad blood between the government and parts of society, large parts of society. Whether this war will profoundly enable them to overcome it, or if it's just a temporary thing in which any society rallies around the flag in the midst of the war, but then the real headaches start afterwards. We can take a look at what happened in the 12-day war. It was a massive rallying around the flag phenomenon then as well. 2 months later, that was gone. And anger was redirected at the government because of repression, economic mismanagement, corruption, et cetera, et cetera. And then we saw some of the biggest protests in the country's history 6 months later. So it very much depends on how the war ends. If the war ends and there is a deal and there is sanctions relief and the economic situation of the population improves and the government at the same time recognizes that its repression of its own population actually is a national security threat, then there is a chance that they may move in a more positive direction. There has to be change, but it has to be a change that at the end of the day is controllable, so it doesn't just lead to the collapse of society or collapse of the state as a whole, because that would be a more dangerous situation in many ways. But if there isn't that, and you're going to see the Iranians perhaps geopolitically stronger in the short term, but nevertheless very, very much weakened because of the trajectory of the economy will be even worse than it was before, then you're going to see more protest, and then you're going to see even more brutal repression by the government in order to keep the population in control. So I think that the current wave of nationalism is not going to be long lasting. At some point, the average reality of the day will return, in which, again, the expectation is that the government should be able to deliver on a whole set of different things. But some changes seem to be more long lasting. For instance, after the 2022 protests, the government largely stopped implementing or enforcing the hijab, knowing that it had lost that battle against society. During this war, something else has happened. Now women without the hijab are appearing in interviews on TV. This was not seen prior to the war. And I suspect that some of those changes will be irreversible. But on the other hand, that's an important aspect, but it is not by any means, shape or form the real issue or the only issue that the population has in terms of their differences with the Islamic Republic.
Well, you've been very, very helpful. Thank you enormously for
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And I know that I speak for our audience. You've given us really important insights to think about at a time when we desperately need them. And I really want to commend you for the balanced way you tried to give these answers. It is so much better than the herky-jerky, crazy flow of junk that comes from our own leadership. I mean, it has to be said, because otherwise we are pretending that we have a discourse with our leaders, and we don't. They are performing what they think, I guess, we want to see. So you really are a breath of fresh air.
Thank you so much for your kind words. I appreciate it. If I could just shamefully plug one thing, I'm really investing in my Substack right now. And I would love for people to visit it and subscribe it at Trita Parsi at Substack.
Very good. I hope everyone heard it. Trita Parsi at Substack.
Thank you.
And to all of you listening and watching, thank you for tuning in to Deep Focus. Please remember to like, to subscribe, and to share this work with people that you know who might be interested. So thank you very much, and we will be talking with you again in the near future.